When it was the beautiful girl's turn, they took her paper, asked her age and where she was from, and whether she spoke any English. She said, 19, Terni, and yes, she spoke English molto good. They asked her to say something. Baby, baby, she said in something like English. I love you, baby. You are my baby. She was sent to stand in the corner. Pasquale noticed that all the attractive young girls were sent to this same corner. The other people were sent out the door. When it was his turn, he showed the piece of paper with Michael Dean's name to the man at the small table, who handed it back. Are you Michael Dean? Pasquale asked. Identification? The man said in Italian. Pasquale handed over his ID card. I'm looking for this man, Michael Dean. The man glanced up, then flipped through the pages, and finally wrote Pasquale's name on one of the last pages, which was filled with dozens of names like his, written in the man's handwriting. Any experience? The man asked. What? Acting experience? No, I'm not an actor. I'm trying to find Michael Dean. Speak English? Yes, Pasquale said in English. Say something. Hello, he said in English. How are you? The man looked intrigued. Say something funny, he said. Pasquale stood a moment and then said in English, I ask if she love him, and she say yes. I ask if he is in love too. She say yes, the man love himself. The man didn't smile, but he said, okay, and handed Pasquale's ID card back, along with a card that had a number on it. The number was 5410. He pointed to the exit that most everyone else had taken, except the beautiful girls. Bus number 4. No, I'm trying to find... But the man had moved on to the next person in line. Pasquale followed the snaking line out to a row of buses. He got on the 4th bus, which was nearly full of men between the ages of 20 and 40. After a few more minutes, he saw the lovely women loaded onto a smaller bus. When some more men had gotten on his bus, its door squeaked closed, and the engine rumbled to life and the bus started off. They were driven through the city to an area in the centro that Pasquale didn't recognize, where the bus stopped. Slowly, the men climbed off the bus. Pasquale could think of nothing to do but follow them. They walked down an alley and through a gate marked Centurions. And sure enough, inside the high fence, costumed Roman centurions were standing, everywhere, smoking, eating panini, reading newspapers, talking to one another. There were hundreds of these men wearing armor and holding spears. There were no cameras or film crews anywhere, just men in centurion costumes wearing wristwatches and fedoras. He felt rather foolish doing it, but Pasquale followed the line of men not yet in costume. The line led to a small building, where the men were being measured and fitted. Is there someone of authority around? He asked the man in front of him. No, that's what's so great. The man opened his jacket and showed Pasquale that he had 5 of the numbered cards that had been given away at the hotel. I just keep going through the line. The idiots pay me every time. I don't ever even get a costume. It's almost too easy. The man winked. But I'm not supposed to be here, Pasquale said. The man laughed. Don't worry. They won't catch you. They won't film today anyway. It'll rain, or someone won't like the light, or after an hour someone will come out and say, Mrs. Taylor is ill again, and they'll send us home. They film only 1 of every 5 days at most. During the rains, I knew a man who got paid 6 times each day just to show up. He'd go to all of the extra locations and get paid at each one. They finally caught on and kicked him out. Do you know what he did? He stole a camera and sold it to an Italian film company. And do you know what they did? Sold it back to the Americans at twice the price. Ha! As they moved forward, a man in a tweed suit was walking toward them down the line. He was with a woman holding a clipboard. The man was speaking English in quick, furious bursts, telling the woman with the clipboard various things to write down. She nodded and did as he said. Sometimes he sent the people out of line, and they left happily. When he got to Pasquale, the man stopped and leaned in extremely close. Pasquale leaned back. "How old is he?" Pasquale answered in English before the woman could translate. "I am 22 years." Now the man took Pasquale by the chin and turned his face so that he could look directly in his eyes.
"Where'd you get the blue eyes, pal?"
"My mother, she has blue eyes. She is Ligurian. There are many blue eyes."
The man said to the interpreter,
"Slave?"
And then to Pasquale,
"You want to be a slave? I can get you a little more pay, maybe even more days."
Before he could answer, the man said to the woman,
"Send him over to be a slave."
"No,"
Pasquale said.
"Wait."
He dug out the paper again and spoke to the man in the tweed suit in English.
"I am only trying to find Michael Dean. In my hotel is an American, D. More."
The man turned his body fully to Pasquale.
"What did you say?"
"I am trying to find..."
"Did you say D. More?"
"Yes, she is in my hotel. This is why I come to find this Michael Dean. She has wait for him, and he doesn't come. She is very sick."
The man looked down at the piece of paper and then made eye contact with the woman.
"Jesus, we heard D went to Switzerland for treatment."
"No, she come to my hotel."
"Well, goddammit, man, what are you doing with the extras?"
A car took him back to the Grand Hotel, and he sat in the lobby, watching the light glint off a crystal chandelier. There was a staircase behind him, and every few minutes someone would saunter down, as if their appearance would lead to applause. The lifts dinged every few minutes as well, but still no one came for him. Pasquale smoked and waited. He thought of going to the room at the end of the hall and asking someone where he could find Michael Dean, but he was afraid they'd just put him on a bus again. 20 minutes passed. Then another 20. Finally, an attractive young woman approached. There seemed to be no shortage of these.
"Mr. Tursi?"
"Yes?"
"Mr. Dean is so sorry to have kept you waiting. Please, come with me."
Pasquale followed her to the lift, and the operator took them to the fourth floor. The hallways were well lit and wide, and Pasquale was embarrassed to think of Di More leaving this beautiful hotel for his little pensione, with its narrow staircase, where there hadn't been room for the full height of the ceiling, and so the builder had simply used the native boulders, blending the wall into the rock ceiling, as if a cave were slowly eating his hotel. He followed the woman into a suite, the doors connecting several rooms flung open. There appeared to be a great deal of work going on in this suite, people talking on telephones and typing, as if a small business had taken root here. There was a long table of food and lovely Italian girls circulating with coffee. One of them, he saw, was the girl he'd seen in line, but she wouldn't meet his eyes. Pasquale was rushed through the suite and onto a terrace overlooking the church of Trinità dei Monti. He thought again of Di More, of her saying what a beautiful view she had from her room, and he was embarrassed.
"Please sit down. Michael will be right with you."
Pasquale sat in a wrought iron chair on the terrace, the sound of all that typing and talking going on behind him. He smoked. He waited another 40 minutes. Then the attractive woman returned. Or was it a different one?
"It'll be a few more minutes. Would you like some water while you wait?"
"Yes, thank you,"
Pasquale said. But the water never arrived. It was after 1 now. He'd been trying to find Michael Dean for more than 3 hours. He was thirsty and hungry. Another 20 minutes passed, and the woman returned.
"Michael is waiting for you down in the lobby."
Pasquale was shaking, with anger or hunger he couldn't tell, as he stood and followed her through the suite again and out into the hallway, back down in the lift, and to the lobby. And there, sitting on the very couch where he'd been an hour earlier, was a man far younger than Pasquale had imagined, as young as him, a fair, pale American with thin, reddish-brown hair. He was chewing his right thumbnail. He was handsome enough in that washed-out American way, but he lacked some quality that Pasquale would have assigned to the man that Di More was waiting for. Maybe, he thought, there is no man good enough for her. The man stood.
Mr. Torsi, he said in English, I'm Michael Dean. I understand you've come to talk about Dee.
What Pasquale did next surprised even him. He hadn't done anything of the kind since a night years ago in La Spezia, when he was 17, and one of Orenzio's brothers impugned his manhood. But at that very moment, he stepped in and punched Michael Dean. In the chest, of all places. He'd never hit anyone in the chest. Had never even seen anyone hit in the chest. It hurt his whole arm, and made a dull thud, and dropped Dean right back onto the couch, folded over like a garment bag. Pasquale stood above the folded man, shaking and thinking,
Stand up! Stand up and fight! Let me hit you again!
But slowly, Pasquale's anger faded. He looked around. No one had seen the punch. It must have looked as if Michael Dean had simply taken his seat again. Pasquale stepped back a little. After he caught his breath, Dean unrolled, looked up with a grimace, and said,
Ow, shit!
Then he coughed.
I suppose you think I deserve that.
Why you leave her alone like this? She is scared and sick.
I know. I know. Look, I'm sorry about how things turned out.
Dean coughed again and rubbed his chest. He looked around warily.
Can we talk about this outside?
Pasquale shrugged, and they walked toward the door.
No more hitting, right?
Pasquale agreed, and they left the hotel and walked outside to the Spanish Steps. The piazza was full, merchants yelling out prices for flowers. Pasquale waved them off as they walked deeper into the piazza. Michael Dean continued to rub his chest.
I think you broke something.
Dispiace,
Pasquale muttered, even though he wasn't sorry.
How is Dee?
She's sick. I bring a doctor from La Spezia.
And your doctor examined her?
Yes.
I see.
Michael Dean nodded grimly and started in on his thumbnail again.
Then I don't suppose I need to guess what the doctor told you.
He asked for her doctor to talk.
He wants to talk to Dr. Crane?
Yes.
Pasquale tried to remember the exact conversation, but he knew the translation would be impossible.
Look, you should know that none of this was Dr. Crane's idea. It was mine.
Michael Dean pulled back, as if Pasquale might hit him again.
All Dr. Crane did was explain to her that her symptoms were consistent with cancer, which they are.
Pasquale wasn't sure he understood.
Are you come to get her now?
He asked. Michael Dean didn't answer right away, but looked around the piazza.
Do you know what I like about this place, Mr. Torsi?
Pasquale looked at the Spanish Steps, at the wedding cake ascension of stairs leading up to the church of Trinità dei Monti. On the steps nearest him, a young woman was leaning forward on her knees, reading a book while her friend drew on a sketch pad. The steps were covered with people like this, reading, taking photographs, and in intimate conversations.
I like the self-interest of the Italian people. I like that they aren't afraid to ask for exactly what they want. Americans are not like that. We talk around our intentions. Do you know what I mean?
Pasquale didn't, but he also didn't want to admit it, and so he just nodded.
You and I should explain our positions. I'm obviously in a difficult position, and you appear to be someone who can help.
Pasquale was having trouble concentrating on these meaningless words. He couldn't imagine what Di More saw in this man. They had reached the fountain of the old boat in the center of the piazza, the Fontana della Barcaccia. Michael Dean leaned against it.
Do you know about this fountain, the sinking boat?
Pasquale looked at the sculpted boat in the center of the fountain, water roiling up through the center of it.
No.
It's unlike any other sculpture in the city. All of these earnest, serious pieces, and this one, it's comic, ridiculous. To my thinking, that makes it the truest piece of art in the city. Do you know what I mean, Mr. Torsi?
Pasquale didn't know what to say.
A long time ago, during a flood, the river lifted a boat and dumped it here, where the fountain sits today. The artist was trying to capture the random nature of disaster. His point was this. Sometimes there is no explanation for the things that happen. Sometimes a boat simply appears on a street. And as odd as it may seem, one has no choice but to deal with the fact that there's suddenly a boat on the street. Well, such is the position I find myself in here in Rome, on this movie. Except it's not just one boat. There are fucking boats on every fucking street.
Again, Pasquale had no idea what the man meant.
You may think what I've done to Dee is cruel. I won't argue that, from a certain vantage, it was. But I just deal with whatever disasters arise, one at a time.
With that, Michael Dean produced an envelope from his suit coat. He pressed it into Pasquale's hand.
Half is for her, and half is for you, for what you've done and for what I hope you can do for me now.
He put a hand on Pasquale's arm.
Even though you've assaulted me, I'm going to consider you a friend, Mr. Torsi, and I will treat you as a friend. But if I find out that you have given her less than half, or that you have talked to anyone about this, I will no longer be your friend. And you don't want that.
Pasquale pulled his arm away.
Was this awful man accusing him of being dishonest?
He remembered Dee's word, and he said,
Please, I am Frank.
Yes, good, Michael Dean said, holding up his hands as if he were afraid Pasquale would hit him again. Then his eyes narrowed and he stepped in close.
You want to be frank? I can be frank. I was sent here to save this dying movie. That's my only job. My job has no moral component. It is not good and it is not bad. It is merely my job to get the boats off the streets.
He looked away.
Obviously, your doctor is right. We misled Dee to get her out of here. I'm not proud of myself for that. Please tell her Dr. Crane shouldn't have chosen stomach cancer. He didn't mean to scare her. You know, doctors, almost too analytical. He chose it because the symptoms could match up with those of early pregnancy. But it was only supposed to be for a day or two. That's why she was supposed to go to Switzerland. There's a doctor there who specializes in unwanted pregnancies. He's safe. Discreet.
Pasquale was a few steps behind.
So it was true. She was pregnant.
Michael Dean reacted to Pasquale's look.
Look, please tell her how sorry I am.
Then he patted the envelope in Pasquale's hand.
Tell her it's the way things sometimes are, and I am truly sorry.
But she needs to go to Switzerland, as Dr. Crane advised her to do. The doctor there will take care of everything. It's all paid for.
Pasquale stared at the envelope in his hands. Oh, and I have something else for her.
He reached in the same jacket pocket and removed three small square photographs. They appeared to have been taken on the set of the movie. He could see a camera crew in the background of one, and while the pictures were small, Pasquale could see clearly in all three of them, Dee More. She wore a kind of long flowing dress and was standing with another woman, both of them flanking a third woman, a beautiful, dark-haired woman who was in the foreground of the pictures. In the best photo, Dee and this dark-haired woman were leaning back, caught by the photographer in a genuine moment, dissolving in laughter.
These are continuity photos, Michael Dean said. We use these pictures to make sure we get the setup for the next shot right. Costumes, hair, make sure no one puts on a wristwatch. I thought Dee might want to have these.
Pasquale looked hard into the top photo. Dee More had her hand on the other woman's arm, and they were laughing so hard
that Pasquale would have given anything right then to know what was so funny. Maybe it was the same joke she'd shared with him, about this man who loved himself so much. Dean was looking down at the top photo, too.
She has an interesting look. Honestly, I didn't see it at first. I thought Mankiewicz had lost his mind, casting a blonde woman as an Egyptian lady-in-waiting. But she has this quality.
Michael Dean leaned in.
And I'm not just talking tits here. There's something else. An authenticity. She's a real actress, that one.
Dean shook off this thought and looked back at the top photo.
We'll have to reshoot the scenes with Dee in them. There aren't many. What with the delays, the rains, the labor stuff, then Liz got sick, and then Dee got sick. When I sent her away, she told me she was disappointed that no one would ever know she was in this movie. So I thought she would want these.
Michael Dean shrugged.
Of course, that was when she thought she was dying.
It hung in the air, the word, dying.
You know, Michael Dean said, I sort of imagined that she'd eventually call me and we'd laugh about this. That it would be a funny story that two people share years later. Maybe we'd even...
He trailed off, smiled wanly.
But that's not going to happen. She's going to want my balls. But please, tell her that once she's over her anger, if she remains cooperative, I'll get her all the film work she wants when we get back to the States. Could you tell her that? She could be a star if she wants to be.
Pasquale felt like he might be sick. He was trying so hard not to hit Michael Dean again, wondering what kind of man abandons a pregnant woman. When a realization came to him, so obvious that it hit him square in the chest, and he gasped. He'd never had a thought as physical as this one, like a kick to his gut. Here I am, angry at this man for abandoning a pregnant woman, while my own son is raised believing that his mother is his sister.
Pasquale flushed. He remembered crouching on the machine gun nest and saying to Di More,
It is not always that simple.
But it was. It was entirely simple. There was one kind of man who ran from such responsibility. He and Michael Dean were such men. He could no more hit this man than he could hit himself.
Pasquale felt the sickness of his own hypocrisy and covered his mouth.
When Pasquale said nothing, Michael Dean glanced back at the Fontana della Barcaccia and frowned.
This is the world, I guess.
And then Michael Dean walked away into the crowd, leaving Pasquale leaning against the fountain. He opened the heavy envelope. It was filled with more money than he'd ever seen, a stack of American currency for Dee, an Italian lira for him. Pasquale put the photos in the envelope and closed it. He looked all around. The day was overcast. People were spread all over the Spanish steps, resting, but in the piazza and on the street they moved with purpose, at different speeds but in straight lines, like 1,000 bullets fired at 1,000 different angles from 1,000 different guns. All of these people moving in the way they thought right, all of these stories, all of these weak, sick people with their betrayals and their dark hearts. This is the world. Swirling all around him, speaking and smoking and snapping photographs. And Pasquale felt himself turn hard, and he thought he might spend the rest of his life standing here, like the old fountain of the stranded boat. People would point to the statue of the poor villager who had naively come to the city to talk to the American movie people, the man who had been frozen in time when his own weak character was revealed to him. And Dee... What was he going to tell her? Would he assail the character of this man she loved, this snake Dean, when Pasquale himself was a species of the same snake?
Pasquale covered his mouth as a groan came out.
He felt a hand on his shoulder just then.
Pasquale turned.
It was a woman, the interpreter who had moved down the line of Centurion extras earlier in the day. You're the man who knows where Dee is? She asked in Italian.
Yes, Pasquale said.
The woman looked around and then squeezed Pasquale's arm. Please, come with me. There is someone who would like very much to talk to you.
Chapter 9. The Room. Recently, Universal City, California. The room is everything. When you are in the room, nothing exists outside. The people hearing your pitch could no more leave the room than choose to not orgasm. They must hear your story. The room is all there is. Great fiction tells unknown truths. Great film goes further. Great film improves truth. After all, what truth ever made $40 million in its first weekend of wide release? What truth sold in 40 foreign territories in 6 hours? Who's lining up to see a sequel to Truth? If your story improves truth, you will sell it in the room. Sell it in the room, and you'll get the deal. Get the deal, and the world awaits like a quivering bride in your bed. From Chapter 14 of The Dean's Way, How I Pitched Modern America to Hollywood, and How You Can Pitch Success into Your Life Too, by Michael Dean. In the room, Shane Wheeler feels the exhilaration Michael Dean promised. They are going to make Donner. He knows it. Michael Dean is his Mr. Miyagi, and he has just waxed the car. Michael Dean is his Yoda, and he has just raised the ship from the muck. Shane did it. He's never felt so invigorated. He wishes Sandra could have been here to see it, or his parents. He might have been a little nervous in the beginning, but he's never been as sure of anything as he is of this. He killed that pitch. The room is suitably quiet. Shane waits. It's old Pasquale who speaks first, pats Shane on the arm, and says,
"Penso è andata molto bene."
I think that went very well.
Grazie, Mr. Tursi.
Shane glances around the room. Michael Dean is totally inscrutable, but Shane isn't sure that human expression is even possible anymore on his face. He does look to be deep in thought, though, his wrinkly hands crossed in front of his smooth face, his index fingers raised like a steeple before his lips. Shane looks hard at the man. Is one of his brows higher than the other? Or is it just fixed that way? Then Shane glances to Michael Dean's right, where Claire Silver has the strangest look on her face. It could be a smile. She loves it! Or a grimace. God, is it possible she hated it? But if he had to name it, he might go with pained bemusement. Still, no one speaks. Shane starts to wonder if maybe he's misread the room. All of last year's self-doubt creeping back in, when a noise comes from Claire Silver, a humming through her nose like a low motor starting. "Cannibals," she says. And then she loses it. Full, out of control, breathless laughter. High, manic, and chirping, and she puts a hand out toward Shane.
I'm sorry, it's not, I just, it's...
And then she gives in to the laughter. She dissolves in it.
"I'm sorry," Claire says when she can speak again. "I am, but..."
And now the laughter peals again, somehow goes higher.
"I wait 3 years for a good movie pitch, and when I get it, what's it about? A cowboy."
She covers her mouth to try to stop the laughter.
"Whose family gets eaten by a fat German?"
She doubles over. "He's not a cowboy," Shane mumbles, feeling himself shrinking, shriveling, dying. "And we wouldn't show the cannibalism."
No, I'm sorry, Claire says, breathless now. "I'm sorry."
She covers her mouth again and squeezes her eyes shut, but she can't stop laughing. Shane sneaks a peek at Michael Dean, but the old producer is just staring off, deep in thought, as Claire snorts through her nose. And Shane feels the last of the air leave his body. He's two-dimensional now, a flat drawing of his crushed self. This is how he's felt the last year during his depression. And he sees now that it was foolish to believe even for a minute that he could muster his old act confidence, even in its new, humbler form.
That Shane is gone now. Dead. A veal cutlet. He mutters. But it's a good story. And looks at Michael Dean for help. Claire knows the rule. No producer ever admits to not liking a pitch, just in case it sells somewhere else and you end up looking like an idiot for passing. You always come up with some other excuse. The market isn't right for this, or it's too close to something else we're doing, or if the idea is truly awful, it just isn't right for us. But after this day, after the last 3 years, after everything, she just can't help herself. All of her gagged responses to 3 years of ludicrous ideas and moronic pitches gush out in teary, breathless laughter. An effects-driven period thriller about cowboy cannibals? 3 hours of sorrow and degradation, all to find out the hero's son is dessert? I'm sorry, she gasps, but she can't stop laughing. I'm sorry. The words seem finally to snap Michael Dean out of some trance. He shoots a cross look at his assistant and drops his hands from his chin.
Claire, please, that's enough.
Then he looks at Shane Wheeler and leans forward on his desk.
I love it.
Claire laughs a few more times, dying sounds. She wipes the tears from her eyes and sees that Michael is serious.
It's perfect. He says. It's exactly the kind of film I set out to make when I started in this business.
Claire falls back in her chair, stunned, hurt, even, beyond the point she realized was possible anymore.
It's brilliant, Michael says, warming up to the idea. An epic, untold story of American hardship.
And now he turns to Claire.
Let's option this outright. I want to go to the studio with it.
He turns back to Shane.
If you're amenable, we'll do a short 6-month option agreement while I try to set this up with the studio. Say $10,000? Obviously, that's just to secure the rights against a larger purchase price if it's further developed. If that's acceptable, Mr.
Wheeler, Shane says, barely finding the breath to speak his own name.
Yes, he manages. $10,000 is, acceptable.
Well, Mr. Wheeler, that was quite a pitch. You have great energy. It reminds me a bit of myself when I was young.
Shane looks from Michael Dean to Claire, who has gone pale now, and back again to Michael.
Thank you, Mr. Dean. I practically devoured your book.
Michael flinches again at the mention of his book.
Well, it shows, he says,
his lips parting to show his gleaming teeth in something like a smile.
Maybe I should have been a teacher, huh, Claire?
A movie about the Donner Party? Michael as a teacher? Language has completely failed Claire now. She thinks of the deal she'd made with herself. One day, one idea for one film. And realizes that fate is truly fucking with her now. It's bad enough trying to live in this vacuous, cynical world, but if fate is telling her that she doesn't even understand the rules of the world, well, that's more than she can bear. People can handle an unjust world. It's when the world becomes arbitrary and inexplicable that order breaks down. Michael stands and turns again to his dumbstruck development assistant.
Claire, I need you to set up a meeting at the studio next week. Wallace, Julie, everyone.
You're going to take this to the studio?
Yes. Monday morning, you, me, Danny, and Mr. Wheeler are going in to pitch the Donner Party.
It's just called Donner, Shane offers. With an exclamation point?
Even better, Michael says. Mr. Wheeler, can you give that pitch next week? Just like you did today?
Sure, Shane says. Yeah.
Okay, then.
Michael pulls out his cell phone.
And, Mr. Wheeler, as long as you're going to be here over the weekend, would it be asking too much for you to help us with Mr. Torsi? We can pay you for translating and put you up at a hotel. Then we'll set about getting you a film deal on Monday. How does all that sound?
Good,
Shane suggests. He glances over at Claire, who looks even more shocked than he is. Michael opens a drawer in his desk and begins searching for something.
Oh, and Mr. Wheeler, before you go, I wonder if you could ask Mr. Torsi one more question.
Michael smiles at Pasquale again.
Ask him.
He takes a deep breath and stammers a bit, as if this is the difficult part for him.
I wonder if he knows if Dee... What I'm trying to say is, was there a child?
But Pasquale doesn't need this particular translation. He reaches into an inside pocket of his suit coat and pulls out an envelope. He pulls from it an old weathered postcard and carefully hands it to Shane. The front of the postcard has a faded blue drawing of a baby.
It's a boy,
it announces. On the back, the card has been addressed to Pasquale Torsi at the Hotel Adequate View, Porto Vergogna, Italy. Written on the back of the card is a note in careful handwriting.
Dear Pasquale, it seems wrong we didn't get to say goodbye, but I guess some things are meant just for a certain place and time. Anyway, thank you. Always, D. P.S. I named him Pat, after you.
The postcard makes the rounds. When it arrives at Michael, he smiles distantly.
My God, a boy.
He shakes his head.
Well, not a boy anymore, obviously. A man. They'd be, Jesus, what, 40-something?
He hands the postcard back to Pasquale, who carefully slides it back in his coat. Michael stands again and offers his hand to Pasquale.
Mr. Torsi, we're going to make good on this, you and me.
Pasquale stands and they shake hands uneasily.
Claire, get these gentlemen settled in a hotel. I'll check in with the private investigator and we'll reconvene tomorrow.
Michael adjusts his heavy coat over his pajama pants.
Now, I've got to get home to Mrs. Dean.
Michael turns to Shane, extends his hand.
Mr. Wheeler, welcome to Hollywood.
Michael is already out the door before Claire rises. She tells Shane and Pasquale she'll be right back, and chases her boss, catching him on the pathway outside the bungalow.
Michael!
He turns, his face clear and glassy beneath the decorative streetlight.
Yes, Claire, what is it?
She glances back over her shoulder to make sure Shane hasn't followed her outside.
I can find another translator. You don't need to string the poor guy along.
What are you talking about?
The Donner Party?
Yes.
He narrows his eyes.
What about it, Claire?
The Donner Party? He stares at her. Michael, are you telling me you liked that pitch?
Are you telling me you didn't?
Claire blushes. In fact, Shane's pitch had all the elements. It was compelling, moving, suspenseful. Yeah, it might have even been a great pitch for a film that could never be made. A Western epic with no gunfights and no romance. A 3-hour sob fest that ends with the villain eating the hero's child. Claire cocks her head.
So you're going into the studio Monday morning and pitching a $50 million period movie about frontier cannibalism?
No,
Michael says. And his lips slide over his teeth again in that facsimile of a smile.
I'm going into the studio Monday morning and pitching an $80 million movie about frontier cannibalism.
He turns and starts walking again. Claire calls after her boss.
And the actress's kid. It was yours, wasn't it?
Michael turns slowly, measuring her.
You have something rare. You know that, Claire? True insight.
He smiles.
Tell me, how did the interview go?
She's startled. Just when she starts to see Michael as a kind of caricature, a relic. He'll show his old power this way. She glances down at her heels, looks at the skirt she wore today. Interview clothes.
They offered me the job. Curator of a film museum.
And are you taking it?
I haven't decided.
He nods.
Look, I really need your help this weekend. Next week, if you still want to leave, I'll understand. I'll even help. But this weekend, I need you to keep an eye on the Italian and his translator. Get me through this pitch Monday morning and help me find the actress and her kid. Can you do that for me, Claire?
She nods. Of course, Michael. Then, quietly, so, is it? Your kid?
Michael Dean laughs, looks to the ground, and then back up again.
Do you know the old saying about success having 1,000 fathers and failure only one?
She nods again. He wraps the coat around himself again.
In that sense, this little fucker might be the only child I ever had.
Chapter 10. The UK Tour. August 2008. Edinburgh, Scotland. Some skinny Irish kid knocking into Pat Bender's shoulder in a Portland bar. That's what started it. Pat turned and saw pale, saw-gapped front teeth and Superman hair, saw black glasses, Dandy Warhol's t-shirt.
3 weeks in America? You know what I hate most?
The kid asked.
You bloody Sparts.
He nodded toward the muted Mariners game on the bar TV.
In fact, maybe you can explain something about baseball that I don't quite get.
Before Pat could speak, the kid yelled,
Everything!
And slid into Pat's booth.
I'm Joe, he said. Admit it, Americans suck at every sport you didn't invent.
Actually, Pat said, I suck at American sports too. This seemed to amuse and satisfy Joe, and he pointed to Pat's guitar case, perched next to him in the booth like a bored date.
And do you play that larrivée?
Across the street, Pat said. In an hour.
Seriously? I'm a bit of a club promoter, Joe said. What kind of stuff you play?
Failed mostly, Pat said. I used to front this band, the Reticence. No response, and Pat felt pathetic for trying. And how to describe what he did now, which had begun as a talky acoustic set, like that old show Storytellers, but after a year had evolved into a comic music monologue, Spalding Gray with guitar. Well, he told Joe, I sit on a stool and I sing a little. I tell some funny stories, confess to a lot of bullshit, and once every few months after the show, I do some amateur gynecology. And that was how it all started. The whole notion of a UK tour. Like every highlight of Pasquale Pat Bender's grubby little career, it wasn't even his idea. It was this Joe, who sat midway back in a half-full club, laughing at Showerpalooza, Pat's song about the way jam bands stink, howling at Pat's riff about his band's stoned liner notes reading like a Chinese food menu, singing along with the crowd at the chorus of, Why are drummers so ducking fum? There was something magnetic about this Joe. Any other night, Pat would have focused on this little stab at a front table, white panties, strobe flashing beneath her skirt. But he kept hearing Joe's hoarse laugh, which was bigger than the kid himself, and by the time Pat pivoted into the dark confessional part of the show, the drugs and breakups, Joe was deeply affected, removing his glasses and dabbing his eyes to the chorus of Pat's most heartfelt song, Lydia. It's an old line, you're too good for me. Yeah, it's not you, it's me. But Lydia, baby, what if that's the one true thing you ever got from me? Afterward, the kid was crazy with praise. He said it was unlike anything he'd ever seen. Funny and honest and smart, the music and comic observations complementing each other perfectly.
And that song, Lydia, Jesus, Pat!
Just as Pat figured, Lydia had made Joe wistful about some girl he'd never gotten over. And he was compelled to tell the whole story, most of which Pat ignored. No matter how much they laughed during the rest of the show, young men were always moved by that song, and its description of the end of a relationship. Pat endlessly surprised at the way they mistook its cold, bitter refutation of romantic negation. Did I ever even exist before your brown eyes? For a love song. Joe started talking right off about Pat performing in London. It was silly talk at midnight, intriguing at one, plausible at two,
and by 4:30, smoking Joe's weed and listening to old Reddison songs in Pat's apartment in northeast Portland.
"This is fuck me brilliant, Pat. Have I never heard this?"
The idea had clicked into a plan. A whole range of Pat's money girl career troubles solved by that simple phrase, UK tour. Joe said that London and Edinburgh were perfect for Pat's edgy, smart musical comedy, a circuit of intimate clubs and comedy festivals farmed by eager booking agents and TV scouts. 5 a.m. in Portland was 1 p.m. in Edinburgh, so Joe stepped outside to make a call and came back giddy. An organizer at the Fringe Festival there remembered the reticence and said there was an opening for a last-minute fill-in. It was all set. Pat just had to get from Oregon to London, and Joe would take care of the rest. Lodging, food, transportation, 6 weeks of guaranteed paid gigs, with the potential for more. Hands were shaken, backs clapped, and by morning, Pat was contacting his students and canceling lessons for the month. Pat hadn't felt so excited since his 20s. Here he was, heading back out on the road, some 25 years after he started. Of course, old fans were sometimes disappointed to see him now, not just that the old frontman of the Reticence was doing musical comedy, ignoring Pat's fine distinction, he was a comic musical monologuist, but that Pat Bender was even alive, that he hadn't gone that gorgeous corpse route. Strange how a musician's very survival made him suspect. As if all the crazy shit of his heyday had been just a pose. Pat had tried writing a song about this strange feeling. "So Sorry to Be Here," he called it. But the song got bogged down in that junky braggadocio and he never performed it. But now he wondered if there hadn't been a purpose to all that surviving. The second chance to do something big. And yet, as excited as he was, even as he typed emails to the few friends he could still ask for money. "Amazing opportunity! Break I've been waiting for!" Pat couldn't block out a sobering voice. "You're 45, running off like some 20-year-old with a fantasy of getting famous in Europe?" Pat used to imagine such cold water warnings in the voice of his mother, Dee, who had tried to be an actress in her youth, and whose every impulse was to tamp down her son's ambition with her own disillusionment. "Just ask yourself," she'd say when he wanted to join a band, or quit a band, or kick a guy out of a band, or move to New York, or leave New York. "Is this about the art, or is it really about something else?" "What a stupid question," he finally said to her. "Everything is about something else. The art is about something else. That fucking question is about something else." But this time, it wasn't his mom's cautionary voice that Pat heard. It was Lydia. The last time he saw her, a few weeks after their fourth breakup. That day he'd gone to her apartment, apologized yet again, and promised to get sober. For the first time in his life, he told her, he was seeing things clearly. He'd already managed to quit doing almost everything she objected to. And he'd finished the job if that's what it took to get her back. Lydia was unlike anyone he'd ever known. Smart, funny, self-aware, and shy. Beautiful, too, although she didn't see it, which was the key to her attraction, that she looked the way she did with no self-consciousness, no embellishment. Other women were like presents he was constantly disappointing and unwrapping, but Lydia was like this secret, so lovely beneath her baggy dresses and low-brimmed linen cap. On the last day he saw her, Pat had gently removed that hat. He'd looked into those whiskey-brown eyes. "Baby," he said, "more than music, booze, anything, it's you that I need." That day Lydia stared at him, her eyes wet with regret. She gently took her cap back. "Jesus, Pat," she said quietly. "Listen to you. You're like some kind of epiphany addict." Irish Joe had a buddy in London named Curtis, a big, bald hip-hop hooligan, and they stayed in the cramped Southwark flat that Curtis shared with his pale girlfriend, Umi. Pat had never been to London before. He had been to Europe only once, in fact, on a high school exchange trip his mom arranged because she wanted him to see Italy. He never made it. A girl in Berlin and a pinch of coke got him sent home early for various violations of tour protocol and human decency. There was always talk of a Japanese tour with a reticence, so much that it became a banned joke, Pat and Benny balking at their one real chance, refusing to open for the Stone Temple douchebags. So this would be the first time Pat performed outside of North America.
"Portland," said pale Umi upon meeting him. "Like the Decembrists."
Pat had experienced the same thing in the 90s when he told New Yorkers he was from Seattle. They'd mutter, "Nirvana," or "Pearl Jam," and Pat would grit his teeth and pretend some camaraderie with those ass-smelling latecomer poser flannel bands. Funny how Portland, Seattle's goofy little brother, had achieved similar alt-cool coin. The plan in London was for Pat to open in this basement club, Troupe, where Curtis worked as a bouncer. Once Pat got to London, though, Joe decided that Edinburgh would be a better place to start, that Pat could refine his show there and use the reviews from the Fringe Festival to build momentum in advance of London. So Pat worked up a shorter, funnier version of the show, a 30-minute monologue interspersed with 6 songs. "Hi, I'm Pat Bender, and if I look familiar, it's because I used to be the singer for one of those bands your pretentious friends talked about to show what obscure musical taste they had. That or we fucked in the bathroom of a club somewhere. Either way, I'm sorry you never heard from me again." He performed the show for Joe and his friends in the flat. He planned to go easy on the darker stuff, and to cut the one serious song, Lydia, from this shortened show. But Joe insisted he include it. He said it was the emotional pivot of the whole bloody thing. So Pat kept it, and performed it in the flat, Joe once again removing his glasses and wiping his eyes. After the rehearsal, Umi was as enthusiastic as Joe about the show's prospects. Even quiet, brooding Curtis admitted that it was quite good. The London flat had exposed pipes and old rotting carpet, and for the week they stayed there, Pat never felt at home. Certainly not the way Joe did, sitting around all day with Curtis in their dirty gray boxer briefs getting high. Joe, it turned out, had been a bit broad in describing himself as a club promoter. He was more of a hanger-on-slash-hash dealer, people occasionally stopping by the flat to buy from him. After a few days with these kids, the 20-year age difference steepened for Pat. The musical references, the sloppy tracksuits, the way they slept in and never showered, and didn't seem to notice it was 11:30, and they were all still in their underwear. Pat couldn't sleep more than a few hours at a time, so each morning he cleared out while the others slept. He walked the city, trying to imprint it on his foggy mind, but he was always getting lost on its curving, narrow streets and lanes, with their abruptly changing names, arterial endings and alleys. Pat felt more disoriented each day, not so much by London as by his own ability to absorb it, by his crusty old man's list of complaints. "Why can't I figure out where I am, or which way to look when crossing a street? Why are the coins so counterintuitive? Are all of the sidewalks this crowded? Why is everything so expensive?" Broke, all Pat could do was walk around and look, at free museums mostly, which gradually overwhelmed him. Room after room of paintings at the National Gallery, relics at the British Museum, everything at the Victoria and Albert. He was ODing on culture. Then on their last day in London, Pat wandered into the Tate Modern, into the vast empty hall, and was floored by the audacity of the art, and the sheer scale of the museum. It was like trying to take in the ocean, or the sky. Maybe it was a lack of sleep, but he felt physically shaken, almost nauseated. Upstairs he wandered among a collection of surrealist paintings and felt undone by the nervy, opaque genius of their expression. Bacon, Magritte, and especially Picabia, who, according to the gallery notes, had divided the world into two simple categories, failures and unknowns. He was a bug beneath a magnifying glass, the art focused to a blinding hot point on his sleepless skull. By the time he left the museum, Pat was nearly hyperventilating. Outside was no better. The space-age Millennium Bridge fed like a spoon into the mouth of St. Paul's Cathedral, London crashing its tones, eras, and genres recklessly, disorienting Pat even more with these massive, fearless juxtapositions. Modernist against neoclassic, against Tudor, against skyscraper. At the other end of the bridge, Pat came across a little quartet, cello, two violins, electric piano, kids playing Bach over the Thames for change. He sat and listened, trying to catch his breath, but awestruck by their casual proficiency, by their simple brilliance. Christ, if street musicians could do that, what was he doing here? He'd always felt insecure about his own musicianship. He could chunk along with anyone on the guitar and be dynamic on stage, but Benny was the real musician. They'd written hundreds of songs together, but standing on the street, listening to these four kids matter-of-factly play the canon, Pat suddenly saw his best songs as ironic trifles, smart-ass commentaries on real music, mere jokes. Jesus, had Pat ever made anything beautiful? The music these kids played was like a centuries-old cathedral. Pat's life work had all the lasting power and grace of a trailer. For him, music had always been a pose, a kid's pissed-off reaction to aesthetic grace. He'd spent his whole life giving beauty the finger. Now he felt empty, shrill, a failure and an unknown. Nothing. Then Pat did something he hadn't done in years. Walking back to Curtis's flat, he saw a funky music store, a big red storefront called Reckless Records. And after pretending to browse a while, Pat asked the clerk if they had anything by the Reticence. "All right, eh," the clerk said, his pocked face sliding into recognition. "Late '80s, early '90s, sort of a soft pop punk thing." "I wouldn't say soft. Yeah, one of them grunge outfits." "No, they were before that. Yeah, we wouldn't have anything by them," the clerk said. "We do more, you know, relevant stuff." Pat thanked him and left the store. This was probably why Pat slept with Umi when he got back to the flat. Or maybe it was just her being alone in her underwear, Joe and Curtis having gone to watch a football match at a pub. "Okay if I sit?" Pat asked, and she swung her legs around on the couch, and he stared at the little triangle of her panties. And soon they were fumbling, lurching, as awkward as London traffic. "Umi, we mightn't let Curtie know about this." Until they found a rhythm, and eventually, as he'd done so many times before, Pat Bender fucked himself back into existence. Afterward, with only their legs touching, Umi peppered him with personal questions the way someone might inquire about the fuel economy of a car she's just test-driven. Pat answered honestly, without being forthcoming. Had he ever been married? No. Not even close? Not really. But what about that song Lydia? Wasn't she the love of his life? It amazed him what people heard in that song. Love of his life? There was a time when he thought so. He remembered the apartment they'd shared in Alphabet City, barbecuing on the little balcony and doing the crossword puzzle on Sunday mornings. But what had Lydia said after she caught him with another woman? "If you really do love me, then it's even worse, the way you act. It means you're cruel." "No," Pat told Umi. "Lydia wasn't the love of his life. Just another girl." They moved backward this way, from intimacy to small talk. "Where was he from?" "Seattle, though he'd lived in New York for a few years, and most recently in Portland." "Siblings?" "Nope, just him and his mother." "What about his father?" "Never really knew the man. Owned a car dealership, wanted to be a writer. Died when Pat was 4.
I'm sorry. You must be awfully close to your mum, then.
Actually, I haven't talked to her in more than a year.